These days, everyone who has a mobile device can take great photos and shoot videos, showing up all the time on Flickr, Instagram, Facebook, and a host of other social media sites. You point your phone and shoot a picture. Sometimes it's a hit, and many times it's a miss. So what separates the amateurs from the pros? For over 125 years, Dodd Camera has assisted photographers, both professional and amateur, with state-of-the-art cameras, lenses, lighting and darkroom equipment, and class instruction. You can learn about new equipment from their blog or attend one of the many in-store events. The folks at Dodd Camera are helpful, professional, and experienced. They'll take the time to answer your questions and give you advice you can use. You may go to doddcamera.com to find out more. And finally, we wish to thank Dodd Camera for sponsoring the Outspoken Cyclist podcast.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for January 6th, 2018. I hope you're warm and safe. I hope you're away from the bitter winds and the cyclone bombs, whatever they are. I think it's a new term they just made up for all the crazy climate stuff that's going on. So for our first show this year, I wanted to take you away from the cold and snow. We're going to talk about summertime bike tours and a new triathlon in Philadelphia, as well as a chat with frame builder Sean Walling from Soulcraft Cycles. Peter Williams owns East Wind Cycle. It's a rather unusual touring company out of Halifax, Nova Scotia. So instead of picking a tour from a catalog, East Wind tailors your Canadian tour exactly the way you want it. Whether it's for 2 or 20, Peter will offer up routes that include those sites you want to see, the distances you want to ride, the kind of food you want to eat, and the places you want to stop. There is a new option coming online in spring for a Cuba Oriente tour that highlights some pristine parts of the country not usually touted in the brochures and ads you'll see. After a break, I speak with Steve Del Monte from Delmo Sports. It's a boutique racing organization that offers events within a very small area of the East Coast. Steve's award-winning race series will add the Philadelphia All-Women Sprint Triathlon this coming July. I wanted to know why he stays within the small radius of his home in the southern tip of New Jersey, why he's producing an all-women's tri, and what matters to him as a race director. Then we're going to take another quick break and come back to speak with Sean Walling from Soulcraft Cycles in Petaluma, California. Back in 2012, when Brian and I were on the West Coast, we drove up to Petaluma to visit the original Salsa Cycles guy, Ross Schaefer. There on the quirky and extensive property that Ross and his wife owned was a workshop for Soulcraft Cycles. Sean Walling worked with Ross for many years until striking out on his own, along with Matt Nyree, to form Soulcraft. Today, Sean is actually on hiatus from building frames. We're going to hear what he's doing and delve into his philosophy. So first, it's up to Halifax, Nova Scotia, to chat with East Wind Cycles' Peter Williams. Hello, Peter. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me today.
Oh, great. Thanks for having me.
So you're somewhere in Nova Scotia in Halifax. Is that where you live?
Yeah, that's where I live, and that's where I operate my cycle touring business out of.
Well, you sound very Canadian, eh? I have a Canadian son-in-law, so I get it. You know, he talks just like you. So it's very cute. It's very authentic.
So, there you go.
Yeah. So this wonderful email came across my Outspoken Cyclist feed about East Wind Cycle. And I'm thinking, here we are in the depths of winter. Let's talk about bicycle touring when it's warm and sunny and fun. So I want to know about East Wind, and I want to know about Peter. Tell me a little bit about yourself and how you started this company.
Well, I've been a lifelong cyclist, and over the years I've been involved in tourism and food-related businesses, and I also got started with East Wind Cycle as an outgrowth of a career in racing in way back in the mid-90s now, so been operating the company as a bicycle tour company for many years, over 20 years, and I still enjoy it, and I really love showing new people all the ins and outs of Atlantic Canada.
Well, you have, first of all, a niche, but more importantly, you have an interesting business model, one that I think will appeal to a lot of our listeners, because it's not one of these look at a catalog, sign up for a tour, here's where we're going, here's what we're doing. It's much more personalized than that. And I think it's kind of an interesting way to offer cycle touring in a guided way, and yet you get to do a lot of what you want to do. So one of the things you do in addition to these personalized tours is you work within people's budgets, which I think is also cool. So explain to us how East Wind Cycle offers a tour.
Well, I really appreciate the way you've read through the website and kind of understand the message that we're trying to give, which is both what we do and B, how we differentiate between other larger companies. Now, I've worked for and with many of the larger companies, such as Vermont Bicycle Touring, Backroads, any of the big ones that come to Nova Scotia. Yeah, what we do, what we really focus on is customizing tours. I found that to be the best market of late, of the last number of years. And so it's a process that I always, after a first contact is made and there's somebody shows interest, and now that can be a group size, just to make note, of anywhere from, we've done as few as 2 to as many as 30. So very flexible there. In any case, once the initial contact is made, I try to figure out what the people actually are looking for in terms of a bike trip. Do they want them several days? Do they want a challenge? Is it a mixed group of cyclists? So, which happens very often. We get cyclists in that are friends or family, and some are better riders than others, and we try to accommodate them all within the context of the trip. Now, you were asking about price points, and yes, I mean, I also try to find out from people what kind of price point that they want to hit. And we can kind of, the main costs of operating a bike tour beyond the obvious, the bikes and the guides and the vans and that sort of thing, is the accommodations and meals. And that's where the flexibility lies. So we can go, for example, in our Quebec tour, we stay in a 5-star relay and chateau in Quebec City, which naturally amps the price up a lot. But we can also find simple motels and bring the price down.
See, I think that that's really a wise thing to do today, because there are so many people who want to go bike touring who don't want to try and plan it on their own, who don't want to schlep their bike from one end of the country to the other, and yet might not be able to take a $10,000 tour, which is, you know, that's an expensive tour, and a lot of them are that expensive. And then again, there are people who are going, yeah, I want 5-star everything. So I certainly understand the different parts of that. Tell me a little bit about the food, because some of your tours, one of your tours especially, and I want to talk about it a little bit later, is this sort of one-day thing that you do with the winery and the cheese, the fromage. It sounds so interesting. What kind of options do you have in your Canadian tours? Because we're going to talk about a tour that's coming up that hasn't yet happened.
You know, for me, having been a restaurateur for many, many years, as well as a bicycle tour guide, food is very important to me, both personally and on a business sense. And one of my sayings to myself is that, you know, really, it's the same price for good food or bad food. And why not choose really good food? So I put a lot of effort into finding the restaurants and the right places to recommend to people. And also in all these areas that we work in, I've been coming through for many, many years. So I know all the restaurants in each location, and I know which one is good and which one is bad. And those are things that are kind of hard to find out remotely, you know? I mean, sure, we have TripAdvisor and all the different review sites, but I think nothing really beats an insider's knowledge.
Yeah, I would agree. That's a really good thing. Nothing like a firsthand recommendation. Let me take just a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Peter Williams. He is the owner of Eastwind Cycle, a touring company up in Canada. And what I noticed and that brought my attention, really kind of snapped my attention around, was a tour that you haven't yet done, but that's coming up called Cuba. Is it Orient?
Oriente.
Oh, it is Oriente. So you say that it's, quote, the last great bicycle paradise, cycle, utterly spectacular, traffic-free road. I think traffic-free road is going to snap some people's heads around, too. Tell us a little bit about what you found out in Cuba. You know, the United States has a different relationship, evidently, than Canada does. You have been there, and you have evidently traveled these roads. Tell us what this tour is going to be like.
Well, over the years, with an eye towards developing a tour, I've taken three different trips to Cuba, roughly 7 days each time, in western Cuba, central Cuba, and eastern Cuba, which is Cuba Oriente. And the Oriente area is the one that I like the best, which is why I put it down on the website. And I mean, I stand by what I said, that it's one of the last great cycling paradises. And the reason being is because of the embargo and the economic situation in Cuba, which is nothing to be happy about, but because of that, there's very little traffic on the roads. Gas is very expensive. Almost nobody owns their own private vehicle. You know, the economy is just very small. So consequently, there's not a lot of cars on the road. And also in Cuba, everybody rides a bike. So everybody, the bus drivers and the truck drivers and all the motorists know people who ride bikes. Or the people who ride bikes are part of their family, and therefore they respect them and give them space on the road. You know, that said, in the condition of the pavement varies radically. I mean, there's a what they call the Carretera Central, which is the auto route, the interstate, if you will, that runs down the center of the country that's six lanes wide, where you sometimes see more horses than you do trucks. And then there's, you know, tiny little country roads with potholes the size of Volkswagens in them. It just varies radically. But, you know, I can't say enough about what a great place it is to ride. I mean, everywhere we've been has been pleasant, never had any bad interactions with traffic. And that includes biking in and out of the city of Havana. So it's wonderful. And I think there's a lot more ways for Americans to get there now. And we always recommend it to people that Americans, if they want to go, just fly to Canada or Mexico and fly over. It's a pretty normal way to go. Yeah, I think now you have do you have regularly scheduled flights? I think you're allowed to go.
I think you are. You have, you know, it changes evidently from hour to hour that it was more, there was more freedom, and then it was, you know, sort of sliced back down again, that it has to be quote unquote educational, which I would think a bicycle trip would be educational regardless. You know, it's like, yeah, I'm learning about the country. I'm learning about the food. I'm learning about the people. So I don't see how that isn't an educational excursion. What about the food in Cuba? What did you find? So, I mean, everybody loves Mexican food, but I don't think it's Mexican. What is Cuban food like?
No. Well, Cuban food is challenging, really, to be honest. Like, it's not to the level of food that you find in Mexico. And if it's in a government-run place, it's pretty poor. But now more and more there's what they call paladars. And a paladar is simply a privately owned restaurant that's limited in size. But now in the food industry, the food business, there's competition and therefore improvements. And, you know, you can generally, in the places that tourists visit, you can find a good meal. Tends to be simple, but good food.
When do you think you're going to be able to open that tour up? I know no one has booked it yet, but I'm assuming that that's going to change pretty quickly here.
Yeah. Well, what I would do with that is take it on a case-by-case basis. So if there was a group of people that were excited about it and actually really wanted to go to Cuba, I would encourage them to contact me and we could work some things out and make it happen. And if not, I could advise, I'm happy to advise people on how to go and where to go on their own if there's some intrepid travelers. But yeah, you know, we would consider doing it on a custom basis for any group of people, let's say, six or more people.
It sounds like so much fun. I would love to go.
Yeah.
I want to talk about your Nova Scotia wine tour. It's really only a one-day tour, right?
Yes.
Doesn't have to be, huh?
Yeah, the wine tour is more oriented towards cruise ship passengers or tourists that might be visiting Nova Scotia with other purposes than full-on cycling. And the reason that we focus on wine, and we also just note that we do that in the context of our multi-day tours also, but the reason we focus on wine is that there's such a burgeoning wine industry here in Nova Scotia, and they're making very renowned white wines all within a small geographic area. So you can do the old Napa Valley style thing and bike winery to winery and have a really great time in the area of Wolfville. So that's why we do it. And we've done it for cruise ship passengers in the past. It tends to be larger groups, but also of note that we do it within the context of our multi-day trips.
That's really cool. You talk about the Domaine Grand Pré winery and the Fox Hill cheeses and the Gaspereau Valley vineyards. And it's not an expensive way to spend a day and eat and drink everything you want.
Speaking of money, we were talking a little bit about that before in price point. For any of your American listeners there, it's important to keep in mind the strong value of the U.S. dollar vis-a-vis the Canadian dollar. And we find that we're really able to put trips together at a really good price point that beats a lot of the large, more top-heavy American companies, U.S.-based companies.
That's a really interesting perspective and point, one I had that had escaped me. You are so right. So when will your cycling season open? I want to ask another question about the company, but when will the cycling season open for you?
We don't usually do anything before the 1st of June. And then we'll run into, in terms of the multi-day trips, which is our bread and butter and what we do most of, run into the end of September, maybe the first week of October. We do some fall color stuff and get up north to Cape Breton for that. And then we do like day trips through the month of October, again, mostly for cruise ship lines. But that pretty much ends it.
One of the questions I had was about the bikes. So if somebody were coming over from the States and wanted to bring his or her own bike, that's okay with you?
Of course, yeah. Yeah, I encourage that. But, nowadays, some people love their bikes a great deal, and they love to have their latest carbon fiber road bike wherever they go. Or other people are a little bit more malleable, and we have a good quality aluminum road bikes or hybrid bikes up here, and it saves all the hassle of packing and hauling.
Right. Yeah, no question about it. Well, I was thinking about Cuba, too. If the roads aren't that awesome, you should not be probably taking a 25-millimeter racing bike down into those Volkswagen-sized potholes.
Yeah. What I've suggested to people in the past and what I've done myself is find an older bike and take it to your local bike shop and get it geared up for, back road Cuba, and then give it to somebody down there, because you can spend a couple $100 gearing up a bike and donate it to somebody who really needs it, and it makes a big difference. I remember being down there one time, and a fella that was helping us out asked me for the tires on my bike, and he said that all they could get was very low-quality Chinese tires that would last them less than a month.
How interesting.
Yeah, so I was able to give him the tires. I brought, in that case, I brought my bike home, but I brought it home sans tires.
Hell, you know what? I would suggest that put a tour together, and the whole purpose of the tour is to leave 25 bikes in Cuba. That would be awesome.
Oh, yeah.
That would really be awesome, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how can people find out more about Eastwind?
Well, go on the website, eastwindcycle.com, where it's pretty easy to find. I love talking to people on the phone, so if anybody has any... Not just interest in our tours, but I'm happy to answer questions about bike touring in Nova Scotia. I know every nook and cranny up here, and also Quebec. We never mentioned our Quebec tours.
Oh, let's talk about it. We got time.
Yeah, well, you were asking about our main destination. So we have a Nova Scotia mainland, Cape Breton Island, which was listed by the National Geographic as one of the top five bike rides anywhere in the world for its scenic beauty and that sort of thing. And then we also we go to Quebec. And Quebec, I find that our American clients particularly enjoy it because it tends to be a region that they don't know much about and haven't been to. And really, when you get there, it's so different architecturally and culturally. even landscape-wise, that you can fool yourself into thinking that you're in Europe without the hassle of flying overseas. It's a very easy jump from East Coast USA up to Quebec City, and that's where we start our tours.
Yeah, I noticed you mentioned poutine. I had poutine for the first time a couple of years ago. I'm like, okay,
oh, yeah.
You know, if people don't know what it is, look it up, P-O-U-T-I-N-E. And if you do, you know, you ought to get, you could probably get the best in the world up there, right?
You can, but also, you know, beyond that, Quebec, it's an incredible food culture. Like, they were doing farm to table before anybody else was talking about it. There's something like 350 artisanal cheese producers in Quebec, incredible game and charcuterie that's all produced locally, and the restaurants that we use up there really reflect that. So in some ways, it's an eating tour.
Hey, we ride to eat. There's nothing wrong with that. I totally get it.
That's right.
Well, Peter, this has been such an interesting conversation. My husband and I, when I told him I would be talking with you today, and he said, well, you know, Nova Scotia's on our list.
Oh, there you go.
I would love to come up and see you guys in Nova Scotia. Thank you so much for talking with me about Eastwind Cycle today.
You're entirely welcome, and thanks for having me on.
All right. You take care.
All right. Bye.
Bye. Peter Williams joined me from his car in Halifax, Nova Scotia. If you are interested in finding out more about Eastwind Cycle, log on to the website, eastwindcycle.com. Let's take a break. Then we're going to go speak with Steve Del Monte about the upcoming Philadelphia All-Women's Sprint Triathlon and Delmo Sports. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU University Heights.
Are back, and the following conversation with Steve Del Monte was recorded the day before the apocalypse on the East Coast, so he's not even a bit stressed out. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure. I learned about your company from Endurance Sportswire, one of my favorite PR sort of newsletters that comes in every week, or every day, actually, pretty much.
Yes, they have their finger on the pulse of the endurance industry. It's the go-to place to find out what is happening, for sure.
That is for sure. So your company, Delmo Sports, produces boutique events. Tell me, first of all, about the company and what you call a boutique event.
Sure. So my company is located at the southern tip of the Jersey Shore. So we like to think of it as we're the Southern California of the Jersey Shore. We are nothing like what people may think they've seen on TV. Very laid back, very cool collection of 13 different communities along the Southern Jersey Shore. Anyway, I started this company 15 years ago when I was in my mid-20s. I started with one event, one race that I did, and I did that for 7 years. And then I started another event, and I had two events for a couple years, and then a third event, and then it started to build momentum, and we became better at what we did, and we're having more success, and we are now 9 events servicing well over 13,000 athletes. And what makes us boutique is that we are a small outfit, but we organize world-class productions. And I don't go any further than about 90 miles from my home. Philadelphia is the furthest that I go. A lot of South Jersey caters to Philadelphia. It's Philadelphia sports teams. A lot of people from Philadelphia have moved to South Jersey. So I don't go all over the country. I don't do things in Florida or Maine or Kansas. I stick to my community. And the South Jersey, greater Philadelphia area endurance sports community is they're my people. And that's what makes us boutique.
I think that's really wise. Focus on your strengths. Don't try to be everything to everybody. We try to tell people that in the bike business. It's too bad they haven't learned that either. So I want to know about your new event. It is a brand new triathlon, women only. It's sprint distance. So why is it important to you to bring an all-women event? And it's going to be in Philadelphia. I want to say that. That's my hometown. That's where I was born. So I'm a Philly you know, fan. Why was it important that it's an all-women event? All your events are not all women.
Correct. No, this is the only, our first all-women's event that we're producing. We have some of the strongest all-women triathlon clubs in the country here. We're very fortunate. The Mullica Hill Women's Triathlon Club is close to 1,000 women.
Wow.
The Jersey Girls, the Stay Strong Multisport Club, you know, 300 women. The Westchester Women's Multisport Club, a couple hundred women. So we're very fortunate that we have these amazing groups. Wild Harbor Tri Club in my hometown was started by women. It's a co-ed club, but I think it's 85% women. Its leadership is all women. And so we have this, we're blessed with just these great organizations. And I've been approached in the past about, hey, you ever think about doing an all women's event? Because at one time there were two all women's triathlons in the city of Philadelphia. And together, close to 3,000 or 3,200 women were racing in women-only events in Philadelphia. And it's been 5 years since there's been an all-women's event in Philadelphia.
What happened to those events?
Well, the first event was called the Philadelphia Women's Triathlon. It was produced by a local company called CGI Racing, which is a great outfit. They produce the New Jersey State Triathlon. They're good friends of mine, excellent, excellent people and operators. And they sold their event to the company that produced the Philadelphia Triathlon in its heyday. And they created She Rocks Triathlon, which was nationwide.
Right.
A very popular series nationwide. Long story short, the company that owned She Rocks was bought by Competitor Group.
Oh, really?
And Competitor Group turned the Philadelphia Triathlon and the San Diego Triathlon into the Tri-Rock series. If you remember the Tri-Rock series, which existed just up until last year, 18 months ago. And anyway, they bought She-Rocks and did nothing with it. So they had this wildly popular all-women's triathlon in Philadelphia that just went away. It just went away. And so I knew that there was this, something was missing. And to be perfectly honest, I'm happily married. 13 years. I have a daughter who's 7 years old. I have a son who's 9 years old. And I am now more cognizant than ever about when I hear someone say, oh, that's for girls. And so I hear that and I don't like it at all. My wife is a boss in the bar and restaurant business with her family. And she's a boss. And it's amazing how people will come up and they'll come to me. They'll come to me. She's the boss. I'm just here helping. You know, so I start to see these things like, wait a second, women are getting treated differently. And I don't want that to happen to my daughter. And that's an honest answer. And thank God my daughter is like me. She doesn't care. She wants to do and try everything. And I want to create more opportunities for her to do that. And I thought, you know what? There hasn't been an all women's triathlon in Philadelphia in 5 years. We were just granted a permit with the city of Philadelphia. And it just so happens that there is a 50 meter outdoor pool that we can use for our swim so we can eliminate the fear of open water. And this is going to be a perfect fit for us. And the response of our announcement today has exploded in our region. Women are super excited and we're extremely grateful.
Well, give me the age brackets. How are you going to break this race down? Because in a 50 meter pool, you're going to have to do waves.
Yes, absolutely. So it's going to be serpentine style swim. So up lane one, down lane two, back up lane three, down lane four. We're going to do it by ability. So it doesn't matter what your age is. We're going to find out, okay, who's a sub 5 minute swimmer for 400 meters? You ladies are going first because they're going to tear through the pool.
Right.
And then you get into, okay, who's six and under? Who's seven and under? So that way you don't have people swimming over top of other people. And swimmers that aren't as strong, they do not want to go in front of someone that's faster than them. They want to stay towards the back. They want to, hey, I just want to swim with people of my ability because I'm not here to win the Olympics. I'm here to have a good time and to participate and to finish. So that's what we're stressing with this event. So it will be time trial start by ability.
Okay. And then your bike route, it says, is going to be closed roads. That's really cool.
Yeah, I don't play any other way. Every single one of my events has a closed bike course. It is my responsibility as the event director, as the person that has taken your money and said to you, we're going to have a race here. It's my responsibility to make sure that road is as close to 100% closed as possible. So the city of Philadelphia has a great road called West River Drive, and they use that road for the Philadelphia Triathlon, and we're able to do that. And it's very easy for them to close it because it's part of the Fairmount Park system. So all they do is swing a few gates and the road is closed. And so we rent that out. We rent that out. And that way we assure our ladies who are entrusting us with their safety, they don't have to worry about cars being on the course in a major city. We're very excited about that.
I have another question here, and that's about big bling. I want to know, I mean, I'm not a bling girl, but I think there are people who like this idea. What's big bling, Steve?
I'm not a bling guy either. But I will tell you this, it absolutely matters with today's athlete. They like to see that their dollars are being reinvested into the event. You've seen it online. People showcase their medals, their finisher medals at the end of the year. So
True.
Look at my display. And they should be proud of them. You know, a lot of people have made life changes to do these things, and something to remember it by. So we're talking a medal that's somewhere between 3.5 and 4 inches wide. We're talking a lot of color. We're talking a ribbon that's pretty and something that we've taken a lot of time to say, hey, how does this medal best represent this event? And we want women, we want all athletes for whatever we do to be proud of and say, you know what? Now, that's an awesome medal, you know?
I think it's really good. All right. So we need to let our listeners know, first of all, I assume this is not open to just residents of the East Coast. If somebody wants to drive in from Cleveland, she can do it.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely, yes.
So January 17th, people will be able to begin registering for the event. Tell them where to go to find information about registration and all of the things they're going to need to do to sign up.
Sure. If you'd like to know more about the inaugural Women's Philadelphia Triathlon, you can go to delmosports.com. That's D-E-L-M-O, delmosports.com. And on the website, there's everything you need to know. You simply click the link and, you know, research galore.
It's got a great logo. It's really pretty. The Women's PHL Tri.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Very nice. Well, this has been great. I love your attitude about racing and about how to treat your athletes, because we all know that if the participants are happy, the sponsors will be happy. And that's the way it works. You know,
it's not rocket science.
Well, it might be to some people, but to you and I who think the way things really are, that's what makes sense. Steve, thanks so much. Good luck with your inaugural event. I'm not a triathlete, but I will be watching this race and hope that all your women have a great time.
Thank you very much. All the best to you in 2018.
You too. Happy New Year.
You too.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. You can find out more about the Philadelphia All-Women's Triathlon at delmosports.com. And as Steve told us, registration will open January 17th. Let's take another short break before heading out to Petaluma, California to speak with Sean Walling. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back, and it's off to California to speak with frame builder Sean Walling from Soulcraft Cycles. Hello, Sean. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it is my pleasure. Back in 2012, when Brian and I were in Petaluma, we were visiting Ross Schaefer, kind of your neighbor, I think, and we walked right by your shop. And at the time, I didn't know anything about Soulcraft or you, so here we are today. Are you still there, or are you moving?
No, actually, so just to clarify, I rented the shop from Ross. So the barn that was on it or is on his property, I rented that. So we shared a shop from when I started in 1999 until last year, just over a year ago, when I moved the shop to my house where I had built a workshop. So that's where the shop is now, but I'm pretty sure you aren't aware of this other change, which was that I got a job at White Industries. So I'm not building at the moment, but so I've taken basically a year off, and it wasn't planned to be a year. I was planning on having, you know, doing frames on the side probably, I don't know, early last year, and it just took me longer to get the shop up and running than I thought it would. So, but basically my full-time job is working at White Industries, which I don't know if you're familiar with, but.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So I've been here for just over a year. I actually got my home shop done, moved out of Ross's, and then 2 weeks later started my job at White Industries.
So are you still in Petaluma?
Yes. White Industries is in Petaluma.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess so. Wow.
Yeah.
Wait, does this make all my questions moot?
No, well, some of them, but not all.
I'm just sort of kidding.
The one about how many frames I build a year. If we're talking about last year, it was zero. So,
great number.
Yeah, exactly. It was refreshing, actually. So, that's my plan right now is I'm going to stay at White Industries, but just do soul craft as a hobby job rather than my full-time gig.
Well, that's interesting because a lot of what I read about you was about your business philosophy. And so what I'm sort of hearing is the undercurrent of all of this is it wasn't the kind of business you wanted it to be.
Well, it was for the most part, except the money part. That's the part that was lacking. The rest of it was great. I mean, I really enjoy building frames. It's fun running your own business. There's pitfalls and there's things that you just have to do that you may not want to do because you don't have employees and there's no one else to do it. So you have to end up wearing a lot of different hats. But at the end of the day, when you go to see your accountant every year and he kind of looks at you sideways and like, how are you able to make this work? And so, you know, it just that along with not enjoying it as much as I used to because of basically the super customization that has overtaken a lot of the small builders world. And I've resisted it probably more than some other builders where, you know, I wasn't laying out this blank canvas and letting people design their own bikes. I kind of had set models and a structure and you know, only a certain amount of options to work with. But with all the new head tubes and bottom bracket sizes and dropout styles, it just got to be where it was hard to tool up and do one thing over and over like I used to do and really be efficient, basically, which is how you can make money doing, you know, building frames. And that's the background I came from was production, where you just set up and, you know, the dropouts that you used were the same for every single bike. It wasn't like you had dropouts for road bikes and mountain bikes and cross bikes. It was one dropout and one bottom bracket shell for everything and one head tube for everything. So now you have different head tubes for these three bikes and different bottom brackets for these two bikes and three different rear dropouts. So that kind of thing just was wearing on me just because it was hard, like I say, to be efficient. And then the cost of these parts. And I love Paragon Machine Works, and Mark Norstad is a good friend of mine, and I've supported him, you know, buying stuff from him for many years, but this stuff isn't cheap, and that's fine. So you start chipping into your cost of goods, and then your labor's, you know, things are taking longer, and I'm not, 20 years old or 30 years old anymore, so I'm probably not working as fast as I used to. So you combine all these things, and, you know, I looked at my day-to-day work and what I was getting in return for it. And it's like, you know, I can see the horizon here. I can see where I'm going to be in 10 years. And I don't want to be basically where I am right now because you only have a certain amount of hours in the day. I only have two hands. And so unless I can figure out how to pay a lot less for my cost of goods or charge a hell of a lot more for my bikes or build a lot more of them, all of which weren't going to happen, I could see, you know, the future. And it was, you know, like if I want to retire, I can't just keep doing this.
Got it. Wow. Well, and it makes perfect sense. Let me ask you what you're doing at White. Can you tell me?
Well, yes and no. I'm working on a project here, which I can't really talk about.
Okay.
It's not super secret. Some people know about it, but I'm not authorized to spread the word on it. But it's along the lines of the stuff we're doing, but just a new product. And so I wasn't hired specifically to do that, but the timing worked out where I was looking for a change, and they kind of said, well, this might be a good fit. And so that's what I've been doing for a year. And it's going well. I mean, it's at times frustrating getting this thing going, and other times really fun. But it's great working with Doug and his son Alec and the rest of the crew here, and it's an awesome place to work. And so I just have to remember, you know, I'm getting paid no matter how frustrating it is. So it's not like the old, you know, my at Soulcraft, where if something broke and I had to go fix it, I wasn't getting paid. You know,
right.
I was, you know, paying out. I was spending money to fix a burnout motor on a mill or whatever. And here it's like, okay, fix the problem, but I still get to clock out at the end of the day.
So yeah.
It's really nice. Yeah.
Well, so let's talk a little bit about you personally. Tell us a little bit about your background. I know that your first love was really BMX. That's where you sort of saw the bicycle as something, you know, that just kind of sucked you in. Go from there.
Well, I grew up in San Rafael, which is down in Marin County. And I never had like a new bike when I was growing up. I had hand-me-down bikes for cousins and had to sub for my friend's paper route to get money to buy parts for my BMX bike or whatever. And so I never had like the coolest, newest stuff. So, no one I knew did really. But a friend of mine showed me a BMX magazine. I think it was BMX Plus. And I can remember where I was. We were on his paper route, and he just pulled it out. He had it for some reason in his paper route bag and said, hey, check this out. And I mean, it was like a lightning striking you kind of moment, you know, and I didn't know all this stuff existed. I just knew there were Schwinn Stingrays and some other kind of bikes, but there was this whole other world of bicycles out there, and they were so cool. And so at first it wasn't the racing, it was more the bikes. And then a friend of mine started racing when we were freshmen in high school. And I went to a race with him and then just got hooked and started racing. Then my brother started racing and like four or five kids in the neighborhood. So my dad took his old utility trailer and made it set up for putting bikes in, and we would go to Stockton to the Nationals or Reno, and every weekend we'd either go to Napa or Mountain View or sometimes Vallejo to race. So it was for like 3 years, that's basically what I did. So that's what got me into bikes, you know, as more than just a way to get around. And then got my bike stolen at a National in Stockton. How
sucky is that?
Oh, it was really bad. I mean, to turn around and like, okay, I'm ready for my next race, and then, oh, where's my bike? I guess I'm not racing. So, but it did get me back, kind of back into on a mountain bike, because I had bought a mountain bike, I'd got a mountain bike for my birthday. It was a Murray Baja, which is a, you know, pretty low-end bike, and my parents bought it for me for my birthday 1 year to ride to school on, just because they thought, well, these BMX bikes are so small, and I wasn't like the smallest kid around. So I would ride that to school, and I tricked that out as much as I could. And then actually how I got a really nice BMX bike was a kid at school wanted to trade me straight across for my Murray Baja mountain bike for his Race Incorporated BMX bike. And I couldn't believe it. I mean, I was sitting there going, so you don't want anything else on top of that? You just want to give me your bike, and you take mine, and that was it. So I gave away the mountain bike, got the BMX bike, raced that, got traded up or bought a new one, and then got that one stolen, and then went back to mountain bikes after that. I got a Specialized Stunt Jumper Sport, and then, yeah, so that's how I kind of went from BMX to mountain bike, back to BMX, and then back to mountain bikes.
Let me take a second to tell our listeners that we're speaking with Sean Walling. He is Soulcraft Cycles and now a part of White Industries, which produces some pretty fine American-made pieces, parts for the bike industry. I want to, even though you're not actually building frames right this moment, mm-hmm. it's sort of in your blood. You spend a lot of time with Ross Schaefer, who was Mr. Salsa Cycle, and with Bruce Gordon, who everybody knows Bruce Gordon. I even have a button that says Bruce Gordon was nice to me, which yeah, I know. It's pretty crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm kind of interested in your philosophy. You only build steel frames when you're building frames, and your idea was you were going to build frames that everybody could be happy with, including the builder, meaning you came away whole, the customer came away whole. Tell us a little bit about your philosophy on how you built your frames, because you did things like powder coat and that. So tell us.
Well, it kind of started when I got a job working for Bruce Gordon. I think it was 88. He was just starting to build the Rock and Road bikes, which were he had his own tire made, the Rock and Road tire, which is a 700 by 45C tire. And the bikes are built around that. And, I mean, if you look at those bikes and look at what's popular now, it's the exact same bike. I mean, it's a fat tire cross bike. But at the time, mountain bikes were still ramping up. I mean, it hadn't even peaked yet. So people were not ready to get on something like that. They couldn't see the value in riding a smaller tire, you know, width and volume wise than a 2.1 or whatever they were running at the time. So when I started working there, that's what he did. He wasn't into mountain bikes. And so we were building those, and that's how we built them. They were TIG welded. Gary Helfrich, who used to be part of Merlin way back, had moved out here, and he welded up the first, I don't know how many. And so Bruce would do some of the brazing on the dropouts and the braze-ons, and then I would finish file and finish machine and do alignment, and then we would powder coat them. So Bruce had a powder coating setup. And so I was familiar with powder coating from the BMX days, because if you had paint on a BMX bike, 9 times out of 10, it was powder coat. And so I actually got to do the process, painting racks and frames, and we actually would paint stems for Salsa. They would bring over boxes of stems, and we'd paint the stems. So that's how I got, introduced to the actual process of powder coating, and I could see, you bead blast it, you spray the stuff on, you bake it in the oven, it comes out, and it's done. And you can put a bike together, ride it, right then. You don't have to wait for it to cure. And, at the time, Imron was the paint everybody was using on their wet paint jobs, and it was super durable, but you had to kind of wait for it to cure, and then it wouldn't really be fully cured until, 15, 20 days later or something like that. And it was more expensive. So I just saw how cool it was and how much value you got out of TIG welding and powder coating. And it was taking things from the BMX world, which had been there for a long time, and applying them to the mountain bike and, in Bruce's case, a cross bike, touring bike situation. So that was my sort of introduction to that style of production, where you weren't trying to be super fancy. You just tried to do nice TIG welds, nice powder coat, and good quality finish machining and lining. And so what you got was a really nice bike, and for less money than it would cost to braze it or have an Imron paint job on it. But when you're out riding it, you don't care about that.
That's true.
You know, I mean, it's nice to be able to say, yeah, my bike is painted with a fade and Imron and all that. But for me personally, I didn't see the value in that. I just wanted something that was well made. So when I went from Bruce's to working for Salsa, that's what I got hired to do, was the powder coat. They had bought their own powder coating system. And so we were powder coating all the stems, all the frames. And so same kind of thing. We were doing, Ross had started doing his a la carte frames, which were the stock frames, but he was TIG welding them, or he had a Richard Green, who was a old aerospace welder, that would come in, and he would TIG weld everything, and then later Jeff Peel, who worked there, he would TIG weld everything. But the basic idea was the same, where TIG welding, good quality materials and finished machining and alignment and processes, but it was just powder coated at the end and, you know, a good value for the money. So that's where I got my, you know, from both working for Bruce and from Salsa, when I started Soulcraft, that was definitely how I was going to continue doing things. I wasn't going to all of a sudden switch to, you know, doing wet paint jobs or super fancy paint jobs. So my kind of philosophy was, you should be able to drive to your painter, or, you know, have it close enough to where you don't have to put the thing in a box and ship it to another state. And then, same kind of deal, TIG welding, not any kind of flourish on the bikes that didn't need to be there. So it was really just a progression of what I had done at Bruce's and what we did at Salsa. It was just slightly updated for, you know, whatever the new trends were at the time. So I'm really just building the same bike that Bruce built, that Ross built, and I'm just, you know, if you look at mine, there's not a whole lot of difference.
Let me remind our listeners, once again, we're speaking with Sean Walling. He is Soulcraft Cycles out of Petaluma, California, on hiatus right now from actually building frames, but has an interesting philosophy, one that makes a lot of sense, especially in today's very, very expensive market, where in the market where you are typically waiting a long time for a frame. So while you were building, what was your time lag? So I call you up and we have our conversation, the drawing gets done, the fit gets done. How long would it be from first contact to my frame is on its way?
In the beginning, we were doing all stock bikes. Well, I shouldn't say all, mostly stock bikes. And I had a partner, Matt Neary, and we had a welder, Chris Hayes, who used to weld for Ibis. So we were sort of like a mini Salsa, where, you know, we had more than one employee, so we were able to produce more frames than I could do on my own. So at the beginning, you know, we would quote things in weeks, and that was still, you know, dealers were still, and that, just the fact that we had dealers, that's another thing that was different back then. We had dealers, and so we were selling frames for like $685, and the retail was $1,100, and so, I mean, I look back on it, and I think, how are we even able to eat selling frames for $685? And let's see, what was my point here? Customs and stock bikes. So we did mostly stock bikes. And so we would say, you know, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, something like that. And then when Matt left, it was just me and Chris, and I was still doing, you know, 100 frames a year, and we had shifted, though, to customs, and so they were, but my version of custom isn't, you know, here, you tell me all these crazy things you want. It's mostly taking the bike you see on the website and making it fit you. So it's almost like what we did with the original stock bikes, when someone said, well, can I get something a little different size, and we would just say, well, do you want the 18-inch with the top tube that is usually on the 19-inch and the head tube? And so we kind of mix and match things that way, and it worked really well. So I tried to do and this is what I did for many years, customs, but more on a stock style basis where we were just making the bike fit somebody, but we weren't going and changing, you know, the chainstay length and the bottom bracket height and all these other things. So, and I always tried to do things as efficiently as possible. So that was my way of corralling people into the custom world and not letting it run over me with all these different options. So
that's a really interesting perspective, one that I can totally appreciate. What do you say to somebody like a Richard Sachs who says, listen, this is the way I do it, take it or leave it, walk away, and has a, you know, some ridiculously long waiting period? Not to say it's a bad thing to wait for a frame if you have five other bikes in your stable.
Right. But. Well, you just reminded me of what your original question was.
Oh, good. Because I don't remember.
Yeah. And toward the end, it was 6 months. And
okay.
That's along from start to finish that, you know, the building the bike took, you know, a week, but the waiting for the other bikes in front of it and, you know, adding in the fitting and the back and forth, you know, all that stuff ended up taking, you know, about 6 months. As far as, and this is something that has kind of came around when the first, when I went to the first NABS, which was the second NABS, it was the first year they had it in
San Jose.
San Jose.
You're right.
Yeah, so that would have been, what, 2006, I think? Yeah, okay. I think, yeah, they had 2 years there, and then Portland, I think, was 2008, which was the third one I went to. But the first year I went to NABS, I was pretty shocked at, the one, the lack of mountain bikes, and two, the lugs and the paint and the attention to detail, but not necessarily the engineering attention to detail. It was really just more show than go for me. Lots of new builders, and that was something new to me. I was seeing all these names I'd never even heard of before, and, you know, you see the media sort of glomming on and going, wow, look at this, you know, and you go, well, that's cool. You know, I mean, there's always going to be, and this is something I tell people all the time, older builders, there's always going to be a Jimi Hendrix coming. There's a Jeff Beck. There's, you know, somebody that's going to just blow your mind that has just come out of nowhere, right? And so you can't sit back and be bitter because there's some new guy that can weld better than you. You got to embrace it and just say, that's cool, you know, I'm good for them. But at that show, it kind of hit me. It almost felt like, am I out of my element here, or am I over the hill? I mean, I was only, I don't know, 30... How old was I? 37, I guess, or, you know, something. And so it was odd to see that emphasis on the style more than it felt like the engineering part of it. Because I saw some really kind of questionable methods of building there. And I still do at NAB sometimes. And I think, wow, that's kind of crazy. And then the pricing, there were certain builders that had sort of pushed the envelope on pricing. And Richard was one of them. And the thing I'm all for telling somebody, charge as much as you can, and if your customers are willing to wait years, you know, more power to you. And I'm not saying Richard does this or anybody does this, but I did feel at some point that there was this race to see who had the longest lead time. And I kept wondering, you know, are you proud of this? I mean, the whole goal where I came from was to get your lead time down, because I mean, at some point, if I'm ordering a frame and I'm waiting 4 or 5 years, I, you know, am I going to be the same rider I am now than, you know, 5 years from now? Am I going to want the same bike?
It's a really interesting point, Sean. A really interesting point. You're absolutely right. Sure, you're transitioning from the age of 40 to suddenly now you're 47. You've, you know, who knows what's happened in the meantime? How interesting. So let me ask you a question. Do you want to go back to frame building?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's a little bit scary how nice it was to get away from it. But I'm starting to get the bug again. And
it's like a drug.
Right. The thing that I will have the opportunity to do that I didn't really have before is to do sort of like Richard Sachs and say, and the cool thing that I always admired about Richard is, he's building the same bike every time. I mean, it's it's just a slightly longer or shorter version of the last bike, and it's red with white. If you can figure out how to do the same bike every time, I mean, that's a win. You got to hand it to somebody that can figure that out. And I'm not totally in that direction, but somewhat, because toward the end of the last run of Soulcraft, I was doing stock bikes again. They were called the Tradesmen, which are 29er frames. I made, I don't know, four sizes. I did three batches of 10 or 15, and I sold them all. And every batch was one color. So I would take them to the painter, and they would say, okay, if you do at least 10 frames, I'm going to give you $75 off each paint job, which was a big deal.
Sure.
And so I'd say, yeah, paint them all gray, paint them all blue, whatever. And they were super easy to build. And so I would just sit there and bust them out. And when I go back to it, that's what I'm going to be doing is our stock bikes. I'm going to offer, you know, three or four sizes, maybe just hang them up. And I probably won't paint them all the same color. I'll give people the choice of, you know, the usual color range, but as people want them. But I don't really want to go back to having long conversations about, you know, how to fit somebody and, you know, what they want on this bike. I'm just going to build the frames the way I want to build them with the options I think that people want, and then just say, here it is, take it or leave it. So,
you know what's interesting to me? And that's when I think about what people used to love about a frame. You know, everybody would talk about the way an Italian frame rode, for example. Nobody knew what the hell they did over there in Italy. They just exported Italian frames. Ooh, it rides like an Italian frame. So I totally get what you're saying. And I have to give you a lot of credit for sticking to that. I think it's a really cool idea.
I appreciate it. We'll see if it works.
Yeah, right.
We'll see if people remember who I am. But
They will.
That's the goal.
I really have enjoyed this conversation. I have to, first of all, give you a lot of respect and admiration for your sort of for your perspective. I think it works really well, especially in today's marketplace. You have to realize when to, you know, sort of cut your losses, move on, and figure out what it is you want, you know, instead of what everybody else wants. So let me ask you my three questions, because I don't want to lose that, right? Okay.
Right.
What's your favorite food?
Gosh, it's got to be burritos from Elroy's, to a burrito place here in town. And they're so good. They have a brick and mortar a block away from their taco truck, which is a block away from their other taco truck. And they're all fully busy all the time. So they're
cool.
That's got to be my favorite food.
All right. What kind of music do you listen to?
Gosh, it's all over the place. I like old school rap and rockabilly, blues, country, old country, like 80s pop. I was just geeking out on YouTube with the Plimsolls and all the bands from LA back then. So it kind of goes in waves.
And do you have any pets?
I don't. Not that I own. I had some cats that were hanging out, and we're feeding them. I think one may have passed away. He's not around anymore. But, none that I own.
All right. Well, Sean, it's really been an interesting conversation, one that I appreciate a lot. And I wish you a lot of luck. Thanks so much for talking with me. Have a great 2018. And we'll talk again sometime.
All right, Dan. Thank you very much.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Sean Walling, Soulcraft Cycles. And White Industries. So that was a surprise to me. And I'm really glad I had a chance to talk with him. That's our show for this week. I want to thank Peter Williams from Eastwind Cycle, Steve Del Monte from Delmo Sports, and Sean Walling for taking time to chat with me today. Thanks so much for listening. And wherever you are, I hope you are warm and safe. And while it isn't going to happen anytime soon here in Northeast Ohio, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.